Welcome to the Portfolio Committee on Police for our Tuesday meeting. I trust that everybody's well. Honorable members, just maybe before we start, just maybe in terms of the program, members, today, of course, we will receive a presentation from Parliamentary Legal Advisor on the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill and the submissions we received during this last 2 weeks. There was also further request by civil society, by Amabugwane, to come to also give a presentation. So I said, it's fine. Let's get more voices around the table. So their representative will be arriving shortly. So we will also give an opportunity to her. Then, members, we will then also take further discussions on that. Then, with relation to tomorrow's meeting, remember we've invited the National Commissioner of Police. There's important issues we want to deal with. Of course, we want further clarification in terms of the strategic direction. There's some issues that we want to still engage on and get clarification. Also, the new structure. Then we've also highlighted some other issues that we need further explanation on, including the harassment policy of the South African Police Service, the new appointments, the Section 45 appointments. There's also the issue of the firearms amnesty that's still outstanding. I see there's a new presentation that we received, so we'll give members also ample opportunity to engage on those issues. Now, members, in terms of the time for tomorrow, our meeting for tomorrow is destined for 9 o'clock, but there's been a letter being forwarded to the committee section by the House Chairperson. There's going to be, apparently, the majority party is going to have a caucus during tomorrow morning. So we're going to just take that meeting to 2 o'clock. So if we just want to announce that to members, 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, so you don't have to weather the Cape Town traffic tomorrow morning between 7 and 9. So we just received that communication. So tomorrow's Portfolio Committee meeting with the National Commissioner and his team will be at 2 o'clock. Then, members, depending on our progress this morning, we will continue next week with discussions on the bill. Of course, after today, we will ask the various members to go back to their parties and consult and get their views. We will take the discussion forward. There's also an excellent discussion document that was prepared by the researcher Nicolette that was distributed. It's dated 12 February. It actually goes clause by clause and also look at the important issues we must deliberate on next week. So I think that will also assist members. So thank you also for that presentation. Then, members, we got an indication last week that the parliamentary program will change. The last 2 weeks, I think, of this term will be committee weeks. So we will try and utilize that weeks extensively for committee work, but also for legislation. The two bills that we have to process, so but we will communicate. I think there's also indication there will be further amendments to the parliamentary program, but we'll keep members abreast with regard to that. So that is just for a general notice I want to make those. Yes, I will remember.
One question. I have in my diary the trip to Limpopo. Is that now not...
Well, we will have to consider that as Manco, but I think the priority is to deal with our legislative. Yeah, we want to ensure that we move. But we'll communicate in due course, so I just want to remind members. Without any further ado, I'm going to ask the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, but I'm going to first ask the members to introduce themselves, as well as the team from the Secretariat and SAPS. Yes, Honourable Molobatsi, can we start from your side?
Lina laka ke nna NG mo lebatse ke leloko la committee e mme ke a lo leboga.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Phindile Mola, a member of this portfolio committee. I thank you.
Matshelo ne ndo livhuwa mushimbidzi wa mushumo ndi mabisi a livhuwa ni membara wa hei committee. Ndo livhuwa.
Good morning. My name is Philip Mtongo, a member of the committee.
And I'm Diane
Colabana, also a member of the committee.
Thank you very much, the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, and then SAPS.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Natim Jengwane. I'm a Parliamentary Legal Advisor. Thank you, Chair.
As
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Brigadier Bert van der Walt from SAFS Legal Services.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Members. I am Dawn Bell from the Civilian Secretariat for Police Service.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Milton Tuana. I'm from the Civilian Secretariat for Police.
Morning, Chair. Morning, Members. My name is Sisama Kaveni from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Thank you very much, and also welcome to civil society and other participants. You're very much welcome. Legal Advisor of Parliament, you're welcome to address us.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just by way of our opening remarks, we have noted, Chair, as Legal Advisor, even though we have not been present at the committee, the extensive public participation or public involvement that the committee has undertaken to try and hear everybody's voice, the elaborate and adequate responses from those public participation interactions by the department from a legal perspective also noted, Chair. And also state, Chair, that our office has been involved with this process from when the bill was introduced in Parliament, before it was even referred to the committee. We were asked to advise the joint checking mechanism on the classification of the bill. And that advice we provided, Chair, also spoke to the constitutionality of the bill, spoke to the legality of the bill in general, and also the procedural aspects. We provided an opinion to the joint checking mechanism, and I can just state for members' notice that the JTM has since issued a certificate for the classification and how the bill should be processed. And same will be provided to you, Chair, the copy. I note this, Chair, because I've prepared a short summary which does not regurgitate what has been presented by the before the committee by the department in response to public hearings. And we specifically start this presentation, Chair. Well, we won't repeat the objects of the bill because the committee already knows the objects of the bill, but I'll just read through that it's identification of infrastructure as critical infrastructure for the purpose of this bill, repeal of the national key points, guidelines for factors to be considered to ensure transparency in identifying and declaring critical infrastructure, establishment of the Critical Infrastructure Council, the administration of the bill when passed by the National Commissioner of Police. These essentially are the objects of the bill, which we don't go into, Chair, because the committee has already entertained those. But, Chair, in the main, we speak to the mandate of this committee in passing this bill, that it emanates from the Constitution in Section 44, that Parliament, in this instance, the National Assembly, is the legislative authority, which is fully constitutionally mandated to pass a law such as this one. The procedure for passing this law, Chair, is specifically stated in Chapter 4 of the Constitution. And the relevant provisions for passing of legislation such as this one are also provided and fully apply, provided for in Chapter 4 of the Constitution and fully apply in the process of processing of this bill by the committee. Chair, on the procedure for the purpose of constitutionality, Parliament has a constitutional responsibility to facilitate constitutional obligation to facilitate public involvement in its legislative processes. This is provided for specifically in Section 59 of the Constitution. But, Chair, there are two landmark judgments by the Constitutional Court that spoke to this legal obligation or constitutional obligation by Parliament to facilitate public involvement. And these are the Doctors for Life judgment, and the other one recently was the Land Access Movement of South Africa, where the court specifically stated that this constitutional obligation Parliament cannot run roughshod over this legal obligation, and that there must be extensive public involvement to ensure that to ensure participatory democracy, and also that all the interested and affected parties are heard in this regard. And as I said in my opening remarks, Chair, this committee has done much to fulfil this public obligation. And from a constitutionality perspective, we can, with confidence, say that this committee has met the constitutional threshold of facilitating reasonable public involvement in the legislative process. Also, Chair, on the procedure, when we move away from the facilitating of public involvement, there's an issue of classification which has also come up during the public involvement process or public participation process. Classification in general terms means the procedure in terms of which this legislation must be processed, be it a Section 76 where it substantially affects provinces, or a Section 75 where it does not in a substantial measure affect provinces. And we have provided our opinion in this regard, Chair, using the Constitutional Court classification standard, as was said in the case of Tongwane and another versus the Minister of Agriculture. And that standard is that in the totality of the bill must, in a substantial measure, affect provinces for it to be classified as Section 76 bill. This, Chair, is in response to issues that have been raised about the classification of bill during the public participation process. We have advised the joint checking mechanism in line with the advice that was also provided by the state law advisor on the classification of bill, that this bill is best classified as Section 75 or processed in terms of the section of the procedure that is set out in Section 75 of the Constitution. In this regard, Chair, just to also emphasize, because this is on a number of occasions, Parliament has ended up in the Constitutional Court merely on the basis of classification. There's Schedule 4 of the Constitution, which is an area of concurrent competence, where a bill can either be classified as 76 or 75, and the list of areas classified or listed in Schedule 4 of the Constitution, which is an area of concurrent competence, where one of the lists or one of the categories listed in that that Schedule 4 appear in the bill, then it is advisable for the bill to be tagged as Section 76 or classified as Section 76. However, subsequent to that judgment, as I noted, the Tongwane judgment, the pith and substance test, which is just the test of appearance of one of those categories in the schedule, was revoked by the Constitutional Court, and it stated that a mere presence of a category listed in that schedule in the bill does not necessarily lead to that bill being classified as Section 76. There must be a substantial measure in which that bill affects a province for it to be classified, or for that bill to be processed in terms of a Section 76 procedure. And as I noted, Chair, that we've advised that it must be classified as Section 75 and therefore be processed as such. With regard to the substance issues raised in the bill, Chair, the issues of access to information, the issues of delegation of the SAPS powers to the private security companies, as was alluded to by the legal advisor of the department in response to interaction in the public hearings, our view, Chair, as opined in the joint checking mechanism opinion that we provided, that those issues do not necessarily render this bill unconstitutional, and that the deliberations before this committee and the clause-by-clause analysis that will take place during the process of this bill provide an opportunity for this committee to revisit those areas that have been flagged, and from a drafting perspective, working with the colleagues from the department and the state law advisor, we can be able to provide suggestions to the committee which might, to a great extent, limit the potential prejudices identified by interested and affected parties during public hearings. Chair, we also just want to state that whilst there are rights in the Constitution and the Constitution is supreme, there is also Section 36 limitation clause in the Constitution, which in essence states that even though the rights are in the Constitution, but the rights are not absolute and they can be limited. And there is constitutional court decisions and a settled principle in law about how rights can be limited in terms of Section 76. When it is considered reasonable and justifiable in a democratic society based on human dignity, equality and freedom, taking into account all relevant factors, rights in the Constitution may be limited. In this regard, Chair, we don't argue that there must be any limitation of rights. But we are saying to the extent that provisions of the bill seem to limit rights in the Constitution, the test in Section 36 would have to be applied to see the extent to which that rights have been limited, and it would be justifiable to limit in terms of Section 36. Again, Chair, in this regard, the drafting team, us included, would look into those provisions which have been flagged to be potentially limiting on rights and test them against Section 36. Regarding the oversight role of Parliament, Chair, we are of the view that Parliament can, through committee amendments, build within the bill oversight mechanisms that could strengthen the bill and also deal with some of the issues that have been raised by public interaction or by interested parties during the public participation process. For instance, we are of the view that the committee could build into the bill a mechanism where the committee recommends people who should be, or candidates who should be appointed to the Critical Infrastructure Council for the appointment by the Minister of Police, if the committee felt so inclined. And we have a number of other pieces of legislation where such mechanism has been used in order to strengthen the role of strengthen the oversight role of Parliament in the implementation of legislation, and also deal with potential abuse of power where it is felt that there might be abuse of power, and also to ensure that there is just efficient application or implementation of legislation. The committee could also build into the legislation a mechanism for scrutinizing subordinate legislation that would be passed in terms of this legislation, be it regulations, be it notices. These could be brought before the committee for the committee's consideration before they are published or passed by the minister through the delegated powers to legislate. And the committee could also, in the bill, build a mechanism for periodic updates on the activities regarding the declaration of critical infrastructure. But again, say this is entirely up to the committee to decide that it wanted a bigger role than is currently provided for in the proposed legislation. Chair, our conclusion as legal advisors of Parliament is that we are of the firm view that the bill is constitutionally sound, and the manner that it has been processed by the committee up to thus far, taking into consideration the public participation or public involvement has been allowed by the committee, meets the constitutional threshold. We also note, Chair, as I've presented, that the amendments informed by public participation and that emanate from deliberations that will take place within this committee present an opportunity to further strengthen the bill where there are areas of concern, and that these may be addressed, the concerns of interested and affected parties may be addressed through the deliberations and the advice that we'll be providing from time to time as the deliberations proceed. This is the short presentation that we've provided, Chair, in this regard, and that we can, in finality, Chair, confirm that we are of the view that constitutionally there are no issues that we need to be flagging in this committee for any further consideration that has been considered. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the presentation. We will now take questions from members, Honourable Karabana, then Honourable Mbele. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Shall I just wait until... No, it's fine. I just don't want to talk and then you're interrupted by the good doctor there. I'm a bit concerned about the tagging, in that there are those references and the implications do have an impact on each and every province. And I'm not too sure in my own mind why you have steered clear of going the Section 76 route, where you have provincial inputs individually. You know, we've had these issues before. We've had a number of bills thrown back at us. We've had issues about the Section 75 and 76 before. Would it do any harm? What are the implications if one goes the 76 route? I mean, what if a province were to challenge this in court, and we end up with a whole mess again, because there are already inputs that say, but no, it obviously should be a 76 bill. Why are you doing the 75 route? So that, I think, is going to come up, and I would hate to see us go through all of this and then the thing ends up in court.
Thank you, Chair. My question is on the same matter, coming at it from another angle, which is to ask if the argument is that the bill does not substantially affect provinces, what is the measure or the criteria or the threshold to determine at which point a bill does substantially affect provinces? And perhaps the gentleman from the State Law Advisor's Office can also assist, because I understand they gave input to arrive at this conclusion. Because if you consider that the bill as it's currently drafted puts the onus of financing security measures on the owner of the critical infrastructure. So that means all facilities, buildings, infrastructures owned by or managed by the provincial departments of public works, as is normally the case, would then have to carry those costs, or the department itself. And in also because where it would be necessary, the provincial disaster management mechanism would be a key respondent or agent in carrying out its obligations. So we're talking about cost implications, we're talking about operational implications for provincial governments, and that to me would seem substantial. So I just want to understand the reasoning and thought process at which we arrive at the conclusion that it doesn't substantially affect provinces when scenarios that would play out under the bill would indicate that it does. If somebody imposes obligations on me that have financial implications, that's quite a substantial matter, and so that's kind of the thinking I have. So just some clarification around how we get to that conclusion. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Molobatsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is the same one that I'm talking about almost every day. I hear you say the bill meets the constitutional threshold, and I can assure you I've heard that many a times in this committee. But the bill still came back to us as unconstitutional. Can you put me at ease that you really mean what you're saying? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Other members? Honourable Mushlongu, thank you.
No, Chairperson, I'm just a bit perturbed. Maybe I'll just need the clarity here. What do you mean if you say the bill does not substantially affect provinces? I find that thing a bit hanging, because I'll go back to first to the object of the bill. What is the purpose of the bill? And this critical infrastructure, where will it be located? Will it be located in space, or it will be located in the very same provinces? And there are provinces in South Africa stand alone. Say, for example, the life at City Man, the Minister of Health is saying that my hands were tied. Yet people died. And does it mean that the national government will have to just be a bystander and say that that's just... I'm failing to understand. What is it really? Even in law, what is it that we are trying to say? Because really, I'm failing to understand. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Maybe a question from my side. The issue of the role of Parliament, the issue of constitutionality, in terms of what options maybe, is there specific examples maybe the legal advisor can elaborate on that in terms of the appointment of the private sector members, what processes can be followed, what would be suggestions, you know, maybe from recent examples in Parliament, what would be an appropriate measure? And then also in terms of the periodic update or the list on reporting of new critical infrastructure, what would be the mechanism to deal with that? Would that be periodic reports to the committee? Will it be tablings? Will there be, for instance, a normal scrutinizing process for the committee, for instance, if there's complaints from an owner? What would that entail? Other members? Okay, that's the first round. Thank you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Starting with the last question regarding the processes to be followed in the appointment of a Critical Infrastructure Council. Chair, the example that I can immediately think about is the appointment of the SABC board members, for instance, where there's a bigger role that Parliament plays in terms of oversight and, or recommendation for appointment of all members to the board. The process here, how it unfolds there, is that the committee advertises for members to be appointed to the board, conducts interviews. This is similar to also the members of the Human Rights Commission. Advertises, conducts interviews, presents a short list, agrees on a short list amongst members of the committee, and then such a short list is then forwarded to the minister or the appointing authority, who in terms of that Broadcasting Act is the president, but in this instance would be the minister, to make the appointment. Honorable Chair, it's an established principle, and it's in various number of pieces of legislation, as I've mentioned. And I can immediately think of two, being the Broadcasting Act as well as the Human Rights Commission process. The manner of scrutiny, Chair, the manner of scrutiny really is a matter that is inherent in the committee, that the committee can itself decide how it wants to do. But there are established mechanisms such as scrutiny, Chair, where the committee could sit and scrutinize whatever subordinate legislation that is made in the department. It could also scrutinize the declaration of infrastructure when such critical infrastructure is declared. That will be brought before the committee for the committee to apply itself into the process that was followed in the declaration, and whether the law was complied with in general terms. The aim, Chair, is really not to usurp powers of the executive, and therefore the committee would just be warned to be cognizant of the separation of powers principle. However, the committee does, in terms of Section 56, have the inherent right to oversee the work of the department, and that it's fully accounted for before Parliament, and therefore this committee in relation to this Act. Honourable Melebazi, the issue of a constitutional threshold. When we make this judgment call, or when we provide an opinion that the constitutional threshold has been met, it is because that we've set and we've looked at all the information before us and all the legal instruments applicable to the issue. Having applied that and guided by whether it's judicial decisions, court decisions, whether it is from legislation itself, all sources of law, including the Constitution. In totality, we look at those things and we provide an opinion that we think that it meets the standard or doesn't meet the standard. However, we unfortunately or regrettably in this regard, we are not final arbiters on issues of constitutionality. It is really the courts that must make the final judgment call, specifically the Constitutional Court, which has on a number of occasions provided guidance, which guidance we use to arrive at our own opinions about constitutionality. And we have followed the process in this regard and of the view that the constitutional threshold has been met. I'm simply saying, Honourable Mbanzi, we can affirm from at our level that the constitutional threshold has been met. You can be at ease, ma'am, yes, to the extent that we can provide ease, yes. Regarding the question by Honourable Members, Kolapanad, Honourable Mhlongo, regarding the issue of substantial measure, the substantial measure we are referring you here to here, Chair, is the administration of the Act, the implementation of the Act. For instance, the issue of disaster management that honourable members have been referring to. The mere fact that disaster management would be involved in the event that there was a disaster in a critical infrastructure does not in itself render such disaster management in a provincial setting as an implementer of the legislation in totality. The bill in totality is implemented by the Department of Police. The National Commissioner of Police is the administrative authority or accounting officer for the administration of this Act in terms of the provision, in the terms of the provisions of this proposed legislation. And therefore, in real terms, the provinces in the implementation of the Act in totality have a mitigated or minimized role, and therefore the role that they play in the administration of this Act is not substantial. But in this sense, it does not mean that they have absolutely no role to play in the implementation of it, as demonstrated by providing for disaster management and various other provincial competencies that are provided for in the Act. But when you test the substantiality in terms of implementation of the Act, in our view, it's not substantial. It's not in a substantial measure that the province will be implementing the provisions of this legislation. However, in this regard, I will also ask my colleague from the State Law Advisor to speak on the issue of substantial measure. Again, just to state that the guidance on testing substantial measure was provided for adequately in the Constitutional Court judgment on the Tongwane judgment that I referred to. And in arriving at our conclusion, we looked at the guidance from that judgment.
Thank you. Thanks,
sir. Thanks, Chair. I agree with what my colleague has said, Chair. It becomes a bit confusing for to look at for instance, as the Honourable Member was saying, that a certain land, for instance, is situated in the provinces, because all land will be situated in the provinces. So you can't escape that. But land is mostly a national function in terms of the Constitution. So it can mislead you if your point of departure would be that, Chair. So the first thing that we looked at would be that the legislation mainly deals with issues of security and securing of infrastructure. And that in substantial measure, that's what is provided for in the legislation. And that was what we convinced us that in substantial measure the bill deals with issues of security. Surely provinces will be affected by some of the issues that have to do with the application of the bill, to do with their compliance with the provisions of the legislation, but that doesn't make them the primary implementers of the legislation, although they are affected by each person. In Tongwane, the court did indicate that government may choose, you know, to apply Section 76 in any given situation, as that would be a safer option. But then it means there's no the process for Section 75 falls away. You know, you wouldn't have a situation where you would use it. So it's a provision that is provided for in the Constitution, and that should mean something, and that should be utilized as well. But it is up to decision makers at the end of the day. They can choose one provision over the other. But in our view, in substantial measure, the legislation doesn't affect provinces, Jefferson. Thank you.
A follow-up with the same issue, Honourable Carlo Barnard.
I understand that you say, yes, 76 would be a safer option, but you chose not to go that route. When you're talking about not only disaster management, but you're also talking about public works, which is a provincial competence. All provinces run their own public works departments. The impact on public works will be massive because they will have to do the work at the cost of each province. And yet you say no. So that's a huge issue to me, is the public works issue and road traffic regulations, everything around this critical infrastructure, to me, has to be implemented by the provinces. So I think it's a mistake to want to cut the provinces out when the costs and the implementation will fall to them.
Member. Right, let's keep an opportunity for comments or responses. Of course, Secretary Saps, you're also welcome if you want to comment. But Nadia, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I cannot disagree that going a Section 76 route as a default position is the safest option to go. The Constitutional Court in the Liquor Bill judgment noted that where you had erred and in good faith or lack of knowledge erred and made a bill, a Section 76 bill, it would be too formalistic to declare that bill as unconstitutional just because you erred onto Section 76, because in effect you would be giving more powers to the NCOP in terms of facilitating their own public participation and getting input from the provinces. So it is the safest option to go, definitely. However, the Constitution also provides for a Section 75 procedure. And the Tongwane judgment provides guidance as to how you must classify between a Section 75 and a Section 76. And the guidance there is that the bill must affect provinces in a substantial measure. So in our judgment, with the guidance of respect, we looked at Tongwane, we looked at guidance that judgment provides us and various other judgments, including the Liquor Bill judgment, and came to a conclusion that the effect to the provinces is not substantial, even though it's there. So we accept that there is some level that the provinces will be playing in the implementation. However, it is not substantial, and that those who implement this legislation are at a national level, at least in the scheme of the proposed legislation. And therefore, we provided that opinion, Chair. We hear the concern of members. However, Chair, we stand by the view that based on the explanations that we provided, we stand by the view that we have provided in our legal opinions here and in the joint target mechanism that this will be classified as Section 75. However, Chair, it is really up to the committee to decide if it wanted to pronounce itself on the issue of classification from that which the joint target mechanism has now provided, which is a Section 75, to a different section, as alluded to by honourable members. Thank you, Chair.
Any comments from the gallery? Nothing. Yes, sir.
Okay, I don't want to muddy what is said, Chair, but just to alert the committee to how the provisions of the bill are brought into operation. So, if in the case of a province, for instance, Chairperson, if they wanted to be their property or their infrastructure to be covered by the provisions of the bill, it is their own volition that they bring an application and they are brought into the ambit of the legislation. So, as it were, Chairperson, it's not as if they are bound to be from the word go to be part of this piece of legislation. It's a sort of an opt-in situation. Even in the instance where the National Commissioner would be applying, the National Commissioner would have to consult the provinces, Chairperson. So the scheme of the Act is such that the application to provinces is optional, as it were, Chairperson. So I think that should allay the fears of members in that regard, Chairperson.
Honourable Mutlongu, and then Honourable Bele.
Yeah, Chairperson. I don't know, Chairperson, because if I had Honourable Kolabana, to me, she's not necessarily referring to property or what of the province, but escalation of course to the local or to the provincial and also local. Now, I think maybe if then there could be a kind of an approach in terms of as we develop this now into that will actually take care of that. Because at the end of the day, it is the national government that actually then allocates money to the provinces. if then I had Honorable Konapanat well. Now, but I think where then the issue will be, it will be the question, say for example, there is a national heritage site somewhere which the government, central government, will, because of interest, because it has got, it is of national value. We need it to be protected. It is somewhere in Bergville, under the Drakensberg Mountain in Bergville, in KZN. Yet, the number of service providers there will have to be mobilized from the province. Leave out the question of security, because security is a national competency, police and all that. But in terms of these other peripheral service providers, I think maybe we will need to bring about an insertion of a particular subclause that will actually then be able to cater for that. So that as then provinces and the national government is actually making some allocation, we'll have then to measure this thing or take care of that particular thing, so that at the end of the day, those who are implementing this are not just going to defer the responsibility without necessarily taking care of the budgetary constraints that they are putting to those people. Because at the end of the day, those people will simply say, we cannot. Yes, we are willing to cooperate, but we cannot move because it is outside of our budgetary constraints.
Thanks, Chair. I think I am largely covered by Honourable Mklongo's comments, but maybe just to clarify again and to kind of shine the lights on the one concern I'd raised at a previous meeting, is that my one concern about this bill is the fact that to disagree respectfully with the gentleman from the State Law Advisor's Office, the bill is not optional. There is no opt-out clause. There is provision for consultation granted. So if a provincial department, probably Public Works, decided not to apply for their facilities to fall under the ambit, the National Commissioner can still initiate of their own volition that, and, you know, fine. And they must notify them, get representation, then it goes to the council, then they must notify the person of their recommendations and those reasons. But the fact is, it is still a one-way express track from the police commissioner's application to the minister's decision. In fact, the only way to overturn an ultimate declaration by the minister would be to apply for a court review. So there's very narrow space for a provincial government who truly feel that there is either weak grounds for a particular facility to be declared as critical infrastructure, or who feel that the measures and the financial implications of that imposed on them are onerous to actually get that overturned. Consultation may mitigate that. I will fully admit that. But all of these concerns being raised are with an eye of maintaining the principle that the provinces do enjoy a great degree of autonomy, and so we can't dilute that, and we can't overlook that, especially if the Act, even though it's being administered primarily by the National Commissioner, will impose financial and operational obligations on provinces, and they really are not in a position to adequately opt out, at the very least, within the administrative process. Yes, we know everybody ultimately can go to court. That's been the story of this country for the last 8 years. But it's precisely the fact that we need to improve and strengthen the integrity and fairness of administrative process within the public sector, so we aren't all running to courts in order to get justice and to get to a place where we feel we've been fairly dealt with. So maybe then the option will be then to build in a proper opt-out clause in the bill. Then that might solve the whole thing. But that's still a cloud hanging over this bill. that we're not not covering that grant adequately. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Ombere. Yes, let's get responses.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Honourable Mbede and Honourable Mhlongo have alluded to an important principle of cooperative government and intergovernmental relations, as provided for in Section 40 and Section 41 of the Constitution. And in all instances, where there are disputes or power sharing between the recognized spheres of government, being national, provincial, and local, there are mechanisms in terms of cooperative government and interstate intergovernmental relations, the Act and State Policy, to deal with such issues of conflict. We would remember, as honourable members, that there are platforms such as MINMEX, for instance, where MECs and the minister in a particular area meet and discuss issues of common interest, challenges that they have with implementation of policy and of legislation. This has been most effective, for instance, in the area of environmental regulation, environmental law, where minister convenes through the MINMEX all the MECs so that all of the issues of a common interest can be raised at that level. So going the court route is not the only option that is there that can be exploited in order to deal with differences that might come or that are anticipated by honourable members in the implementation of this legislation. There is also, Chair, as members have corrected, a drafting option that could be utilised to address the issues of interaction between the relevant spheres of government, to make sure that there is no perceived unfairness or real unfairness that could jeopardise the proper implementation of legislation. These are options that the committee has, Chair, to try and deal with the concern that is raised by honourable members. So what I'm simply saying is that taking it at 76 is not the only option that we have, Chair. There are set mechanisms in government currently in law and in practice to deal with issues of conflict as and when they arise between spheres of government. And there's also the option of simply just amending in the legislation as the members are deliberating to put in a clause that will... to propose a clause to honourable members that could deal with the concerns raised by honourable members in this meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any comments from... Yeah, Brigadier, you're welcome.
Thank you, Chair. I think one of the concerns in this regard is the power of the National Commissioner to do an application on behalf of someone else. And I think it's quite possible that we can tighten up that procedure considerably. And if I say we, I mean obviously the committee, we will make recommendations, but should the committee feel that way, we can tighten up the situation with the National Commissioner, in which cases he or she is allowed to make an application on behalf of someone else, so that you limit those severely. I don't think it was ever the intention of the drafting team, at least, to give wide powers to the National Commissioner to apply randomly on behalf of other infrastructure.
I think that issue of consultation we can next week, I think, when we go to the broad discussion, I think that's an issue we really can take on board. So I think that's a good suggestion. Members, any other questions members want to raise? But I think the researcher as well as the support team has noted the concerns of the members, and that next week in the broad discussion we'll take that also into consideration. Yes, Honourable Colabana.
Yeah, Chair, we're assured it's a simple process to go one way or the other, and I'm a bit concerned that we're being told, but there are other mechanisms such as MINMAC, etc., where issues can be sorted out. The point is, we're not here to draft something which has built-in issues. The issue should be dealt with out, clear. Really, I can't tell you how awful it is for a committee to have a bill come back. And we've had it. The chair has not had it, but this committee has had it. And it is just devastating to have to start from scratch and go through it all again. I'm a belts and braces person when it comes to these bills. Do everything you can to make it as perfect as you can, and then hopefully the dramas at the MINMAX, et cetera, will be minimal. And I think that's where I'm leaning.
I think part of the process is for committee members to flag those issues that is a concern to them, and of course in the next week or so to look at those, and then next week we will go to the broad discussion, not course by course, but the broad discussion to kind of isolate those factors. I mean, I think there is areas where there would be broad consensus anyway. There's good suggestions already, I think, from the drafters where we can tighten the technical descriptions and definitions, and there was good input. But I think, the more controversial issues we will definitely spend a lot of time on, and I want to really invite members as well to maybe come also with suggestions and also possible clauses to look at that we can tighten that. Honourable Bailey.
Thanks, Chase. That's my last question on a different matter. Hopefully it's a fairly small and simple one to answer. Just on the slide relating to constitutionality and the role of Parliament, there is a suggestion that part of enhancing the oversight role of Parliament and the committee in particular would be around scrutinizing the subordinate legislation passed in terms of the Act, so that's the regulations. And I'm aware that in some statutes, the provisions around the passing of regulations only require for Parliament or for the committee to note the regulations, and in some others the provision is that the regulations must be approved by the committee and by Parliament. The official from Parliamentary Legal Services did say that we must be mindful of the principle of the separation of powers between the executive and the legislature. So I'm just looking for clarity as to whether with regulations being subordinate legislation, is that an area of exclusive executive discretion or competence? Because we've had issues before where regulations in the Home Affairs portfolio in relation to birth certificates and that sort of thing had an adverse impact on tourism. So one is mindful of not giving ministers carte blanche to just sort of write their own regulations willy-nilly. But at the same time, you want to give that space for the executive to refine and shape how statutes actually go into operation. So what is the framework around whether Parliament is fully within its rights to require the approval of regulations drafted by ministries before they are passed, and you know, mindful of the separation of powers? Yeah, in fact, that's pretty much the question, because my bias, given our experience with the misuse of discretionary executive powers in various areas, my bias is now that we must tighten oversight and the requirement of parliamentary approval and parliamentary sort of filtering and sifting as much as possible as an inbuilt check and balance in the system. Because, you know, experience teaches us to err on the side of human fallibility than to trust we're going to have these virtuous people being cabinet ministers. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Any other member? Right, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to first comment that legislating or legislative power is the sole preserve of the legislature, in this instance, Parliament. However, that power, in terms of the constitutional design, can be delegated. And the power of the executive to be able to make subordinate legislation is power delegated by the legislature. In this instance, the legislature can decide where it wanted to build itself an oversight mechanism to either approve subordinate legislation, it is allowed in law, or bring subordinate legislation before the committee for the committee to note that there is this regulation that has been made by the minister, and us as a committee, we are satisfied that it chose this particular mischief and that in passing that legislation, the minister has not extended himself or herself powers that are not granted in the principal act. That is, in general terms, what the purpose of subordinate legislation is, Chair, and the purpose for which the minister must make. The simple reason that the purpose for which the minister must make supporting legislation is because that the executive is the implementing agent of the legislation, and therefore have to experience the day-to-day challenges with the implementation of that legislation, which is why then they are granted that delegated power to create subordinate legislation to chore some of the areas of implementation challenges that arise. The options of either approving subordinate legislation or noting it is certainly an option that the committee has, and through deliberation the committee can decide which of those two options it wants to exercise.
I don't want to say we note your input. We approve your input. No, thank you. Members, any other questions or concerns? But thank you. I think it's going to be an ongoing process, because I think in the next few weeks we will have to also tap on your further input when we go to the broader discussions. So thank you very much. We will then go to the further presentation from Omu Bugane Center. We welcome Ms. Rajuli. She's welcome to do a presentation. I think the presentation was made available, but you're very much welcome. We'll just ask the secretary just to assist members if they don't got copies. Well, maybe just again, for those who maybe came late, just to indicate that tomorrow's meeting that we have with SAPS and the National Commissioner will start at 2 o'clock, and not at 9 o'clock. So I just want to remind members, 2 o'clock and not 9 o'clock. Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Good morning, Honourable Buchman and Honourable Members. Thank you so much for allowing us to present our comment on a piece of legislation which I think has got huge implications. We do also appreciate you extending the opportunity to us in extended time. My name is Karabo Rajuli, and I'm the Advocacy Coordinator at the Amabongani Center for Investigative Journalism. Amabongani is an independent, just to say who we are. We are an independent, non-profit media organization founded in 2009, and we both practice and develop investigative journalism in the public interest. We also have what we consider our advocacy mandate, which is essentially to help secure the information rights which investigative journalists and the wider public need. To zoom in specifically on what our advocacy mandate is because it's quite unique for media organizations, we actively work to strengthen legislation to allow for the free flow of information necessary for media, as well as the general media and the public. We do this because we believe as an investigative journalism outfit, we are ideally placed to identify the legal policy as well as practical threats to the free flow of information, which is the lifeblood of investigative journalism, which allows us to do our big breaking stories. Since 2010, we've got a long history of doing this as a team. We have interacted with drafters, parliament, as well as civil society stakeholders to achieve amendments, among others, to the Companies Act of 2011, the Protection of Personal Information Act of 2013, as well as the much controversial Protection of State Information Bill, as well as various others. Our interest in the bill, we've kept our submission very concise to what we believe is a key clause which threatens media freedom as well as our ability to access and impart information, which is the clauses around offences and penalties, which is clause 26.2. We also have concerns that this may not meet the constitutional muster required by this particular piece of legislation. I'll go into detail about that shortly. We would like to say, although we don't make submissions on this, we would like to concur with submissions which have raised concern of the excessive penalties, which this bill does allow for. But we are primarily concerned with the omission, one, of an express public interest defense in this bill, as well as a public domain defense within this piece of legislation. Our view is that the omission of these particular defenses will have a chilling effect on investigative journalists, the media, as well as the wider public. Our first concern, which is not necessarily a constitutional concern, but does speak to our concern around the chilling effect of this legislation, is the lack of a qualification for unlawful conduct in clause section 26.2. We believe our view is that the lack of a qualification, so leaving unlawful without the qualification of intentional, will have the effect of causing unknowing, unintentional, or general public interest breaches or disclosures to the same criminal penalty of actual criminal activity. So it doesn't provide for an adequate distinction between criminal activity and unintentional actions or public interest actions. We are also concerned that clause 26.2d, extends this penalty to the use and distribution of, amongst others, photographic images and recordings. Now, this is a key tool that journalists, the media, use in order to uncover wrongdoing and corruption, and this is not qualified in the bill as it currently stands. We thought it might be useful to allow the members to really understand the context, to point to specific examples where the bill in its current form would have, we believe, an unintentional consequence. The first is around the media reporting around the president's residence in Gandla, and we saw instances where the media was prevented from reporting because of the old National Key Points Act. And the use of the old National Key Points Act, which is repeated in the current bill before us, was used to obstruct media from taking images of an issue which was widely within the public interest, as well as the public from sharing these images as well. Ourselves at Amabongani submitted a promotion of access to information request in 2012 around the cost of the security upgrades at the president's residence, and in that instance, the National Key Points Act was used to obstruct us from gaining access to information, which we eventually were able to to secure, but again, the bill in its current form has exactly the same weaknesses of the National Key Points Act, and therefore it has the same consequences as the old National Key Points Act. Media reporting around ESCOM, which has become part of the parliamentary ESCOM inquiry, would also be affected by the bill in its current form. There were examples historically of the old National Key Points Act preventing journalists from taking images of power stations. You had the network NetBack 24 journalist Skuman, who had tried to take an image of the Majuba power station when the silos fell off, and he was detained, so the criminal prosecution was the potential liability which he faced. Carte Blanche, way back in 2008, had done an expose around stockpiles because of concerns around the kinds of concerns around electricity shortages, and that particular expose involved the Carte Blanche investigative journalists using aerial photographs to uncover the dishonesty around those particular stockpiles. In our own investigative work at Amabungan, we have both had to rely on leaked information, but also some of our reporters physically going to visit various coal stations, including the Hendrina power plant, which is considered a critical infrastructure site or national key point, in order to uncover corruption as well as state capture allegations there as well. So there are key implications around the current drafting and clauses in the bill, which will continue to prosecute journalists in the same way as the old national key point. Old National Key Point does. Our solution to this problem is quite simple in the first instance. In Clause 26.1, the bill correctly makes a qualification of unlawful with intentionality. We would therefore propose that in Clause 26.2, in every instance where the word unlawful is used, that should be qualified with intentional as well to ensure that there's the correct interpretation of conduct. Our last two sections deal with what we believe are probably the more extreme threats to media freedom and investigative journalism, but will potentially have the effect of not passing constitutional muster. We have this position based on the experience of the very contentious Protection of State Information Bill in the parliamentary process, which many members may or may not be aware of, but that brought up many issues around the importance of having both public interest and public domain defences in a piece of security legislation. The first imperative which we think is vital for inclusion in this particular bill is a strong public interest defence clause. Members may remember that in the Protection of State Information Bill, this was a key demand in the process, and through the process of the possible secrecy bill, as it's colloquially known, eventually a public interest defense clause was correctly inserted. Whilst this was important, the clause which was inserted into POSIB still has its limitations. Specifically, it does not allow for a public interest defense for the reporting of imminently corrupt or dangerous activity. We believe this is still a weakness of POSIB and should be solved in this current piece of legislation. A constitutionally sound defense, therefore, members, would be the inclusion of an imminent public danger clause in the least. Section 46 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act and Information Flow piece of legislation is a more progressive and, we believe, constitutionally sound public interest defense clause, which could be used in the bill before the committee. And it has the effect of increasing transparency as well as accountability. In the interest of time, I won't go through all the full section of Section 46 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. I would, however, like to say in our recommendation, we would recommend to the committee that Section 26.2 of the current bill be revised to include an adequate public interest defense. And a simple solution would be to insert the current public interest defense already present in PIA into the current bill before the committee. And this will have the effect of strengthening both transparency and accountability for this particular piece of legislation. The effect of this, we believe, in our own practice of investigative journalism, is that powerful officials, powerful individuals will be able to be held account by members of the media and the wider public, and to ensure that any corrupt activity or abuse of the intentions of the bill are timeously exposed by the media and the wider public. It's probably important to say this as a caveat. whilst we have had our own instances of being obstructed by the historical National Key Point Bill, and obviously with our concerns around this new bill, we are also concerned about media organizations who might be at the community level or may not have the same kind of resources to defend and challenge these kinds of infringements. So I would really appeal to members to consider that this submission is not just for large media organizations who do have the ability to challenge any obstructions, but also for community media who might not want to take on the tough stories at their local level because of the potential chilling effect or criminal prosecution which are present in this current piece of legislation. Our last submission is on the necessity of including a public domain defense. Essentially, what a public domain defense clause does in a piece of legislation, as members would be aware, is that it allows for a member of the public or media where information is already in the public domain but might have been considered classified or information which shouldn't be in the public domain, not to be prosecuted for republishing that information. Now, this is important because this came up very particularly again in the secrecy bill process, in the legislative process, and in fact, the public domain defense was not inserted into the final draft of POSSIP, the secrecy bill, which was finalized by the National Assembly in 2013, and this will be subject to a constitutional challenge should the secrecy bill be signed into law. So again, this is to emphasize the constitutional imperative and the constitutional weaknesses of...
Can the presenter stop telling us about a secrecy bill, because we don't have such a bill in this parliament? Thank you very much.
Yeah. May I, Chair, may I offer a response for why I'm... The reason why we raised the secrecy bill is because the secrecy bill, the critical infrastructure protection bill, and other type of legislation which is about security have the same kinds of provisions and clauses. What we are saying by using the example of the secrecy bill is that to bypass the possible challenges, constitutional challenges, public challenges to this particular critical infrastructure bill, you may want to not make the same kind of mistakes that were present in POSSIP. May I continue? Thank you. The principle of a public domain defense is that once information gets into the public domain, it loses the secrecy, and this is something that has been confirmed by our constitutional court. In our own practice of investigative journalism, we've seen the effects of not having an adequate public domain defense in any type of legislation. For example, in our reporting on the slide has changed. In our reporting of the Mac Maharaj matter, which was in 2011, the Mail and Guardian, in the public interest, wanted to report an expose of Mac Maharaj, who had lied under section 26 of the National Prosecuting Act. Now, essentially, section 28 of the National Prosecuting Authority. Now, section 28 of the National Prosecuting Authority Act is a confidential hearing where any information is considered confidential, with the exception of where there might be dishonesty in that particular inquiry. Because in this inquiry, Maharaj had been dishonest, it therefore lost its secrecy. The Mail and Guardian and many other media organizations therefore had a public interest obligation to report on the dishonesty which was present, because it involved bribe allegations as well. But at the point of publishing, the Mail and Guardian was prevented by doing so with the threat of criminal sanction under the NPA Act. There was a period of 15 years. On principle, whilst the Mail and Guardian at the time was censored, on principle, the Mail and Guardian and Amabungani reporters challenged, one, the censorship of the story, which was in the public interest, but then also wanted to challenge this idea of a blanket secrecy provision, which didn't include a public domain clause. After a long six-year battle, which went through many, many different iterations, we had a judgment at the Supreme Court of Appeal, which confirmed that a public domain defense is essential for the protection of other constitutional rights, including media freedom, and that further penalties, once information has been in the public domain, should not be applied to others who would then republish that same information. What the judgment at the SCA said was that an appropriate balance should be struck between the need for the need for confidentiality, but also the right to republish information in the public interest. And it's this kind of correct balance which we would like to see in the current Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill to prevent the kind of egregious violations of the right of the media to publish, as you saw with this particular Mac Maharaj six-year battle of the Mail and Guardian. Therefore, we offer a solution, and we believe that this is a simple solution. The solution, therefore, is to, at Section 26.2c of the current bill, we recommend that a public interest clause is inserted based on PIA Section 26, and this has been done in other legislation which has been passed by Parliament. We also recommend that a public domain defense is also included, and the public domain defense which we include in our recommendation for drafting is similar public domain defense which you can find in other types of legislation which has been passed by this House. So, members, with that, I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much for your input. We welcome that. Let's get the drafters. Is there any comments from their side before I go to the members? Advocate Bell?
Nothing at this stage. We'll need to have a look at the presentation properly first. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the honourable members for questions and clarification. Yes, honourable Colabona.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I think it's an area that, as a committee, we have not focused sufficiently on. And as we've said throughout, while you've not been here, we cannot risk the possibility of challenges to anything that we pass, so we're inching through all the inputs, everything. But this has raised an entire area which we have not in any greater shape or form discussed, but of course it's crucial. And because you've got a judgment, perhaps you could give us the full, I think you have maybe, the full details of the judgment that's in here, or not. If you could make sure we get, or perhaps get a copy of the judgment, that may assist us a great deal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Colo Barnard. Any other members? Maybe just in terms of your proposal, so if those proposals are taken on board, you will be happy with the rest of the bill. Is that what you're saying?
We will. Not to dismiss the submissions of other civil society organisations, but as it pertains to our interest, yes.
Any other members? Any a final word from your side? Yes, Honourable Colabona.
You see, you're saying that putting in the word unlawful, but, and I don't know what lawyers have advised you, and I'm not a lawyer, so, right, but unlawfully there may already be something that has been passed that would render your presence unlawful. And you're then saying, well, it was unlawful, and it says unlawful, so send her to jail for 30 years. You think that's sufficient? I mean, have you taken legal advice on this? Is that sufficient to cover the journalist speaking to members of staff, speaking to people? We don't even know. I mean, it was raised, if people protest from a certain building out of a critical infrastructure building, do they go to jail for 30 years? I mean, there are many issues still to be discussed. But it's a very simple solution, but I don't know that it will pass legal muster. And that's why I'm asking if you've taken perhaps legal advice on this.
Member?
Right. Our submission is based on our own practice. So in terms of taking legal advice, I think the committee is better placed to get proper briefings on legislation. Our solution is in three parts. The one is to amend unlawful with intentional, so ensuring that the unlawful conduct is explicitly marked with the intentionality of the action. So it's not simply a case of unlawful conduct and therefore criminal prosecution. Our view, however, is that by also inserting a public interest defense as well as a public domain defense, those three amendments provide adequate safeguards to ensure that journalists who do want to do public interest reporting or do want to republish in the public interest are adequately protected without losing the intentions of the bill, which is to protect these critical infrastructure sites.
Thanks, Chair.
Just one question. I think the valuable elements and unique elements of the inputs from Amabungane is the issue of the public domain defense. I don't think that's come up before in any of the other submissions. I do recall that Rights to Know and one or two others have raised the issue of around qualification of unlawful conduct as well as the public interest defense, but the public domain, I must confess, is one I certainly hadn't thought of, and it's a self-evident merit-worthy issue. So that's certainly something I would support. But there's one potential dilemma that I'm becoming aware of, and perhaps Amabungane could shed some light on how they would see it. I think the one position that the committee is likely unanimous on is that the kind of information that needs to be protected and therefore classified under this bill or the framework it sets out would be relating to security measures. So, you know, the issue of disseminating photographic or evidence of photographic images or other recordings simply of the critical infrastructure is complete nonsense. I think that needs to be scrubbed off. But the issue of actual security measures, that's the valid and the core issue. But if there was to be a scenario where there is a legitimate security measure, but the means through which it was procured, et cetera, was then corrupt, illegal, unlawful. And in revealing that corruption, you then reveal information about security measures, which is the core concern. Where would the balance of scales fall for you? Because, I mean, I do see that the proposed amendment is that but disclosure of the information outweighs the harm contemplated by revealing it. So is it more harmful to reveal information about the security measures in aid of reporting on corrupt or illegal conduct in the public sector? How would that space need to be navigated from your perspective in weighing those two interests? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Mbele. You're welcome, Ms. Harrison.
Yeah. Honourable Mbele, that is a difficult question. In policy as well as legislative processes, one principle which was articulated in the late 2000s is something called the Tshwane Principles, which developed a theory around what's called the harm principle test. And so the concept, and we haven't included that in our submission for the interest of brevity, but it's certainly one way of approaching this, is to say the penalties should always be balanced against the level of harm. And what we don't see sufficiently in the bill as it currently stands is a differentiation in the kinds of penalties which can be applied. There's simply the 20-year, up to a 20-year sentence or up to a 30-year sentence. What an application of the harm principle could do for this bill is correctly define when there is a grievous breach of the law. So if there's a huge corruption scandal and the media or others have exposed it, then the same kind of penalty cannot be applied. But if it's a less severe offense, then there should be a level of penalty. It's a huge body of policy, which I think the committee would really need to wrestle with themselves. But I think what we see from the clauses in PIE where the public defense exists, the harm test is quite the harm test, or the exclusion of penalty based on the exposure of corrupt activity is quite high. So it's imminent danger or contravention of the law, which is already a very high threshold to cross in order not to have the public defense
principle applied. And so in our submission, when we say apply the Section 46 public interest offence as it is crafted in PIE, we're already saying the threshold to meet that public interest offence is already sufficiently high such that any kind of expose or images which are taken will already have met the threshold, which is sufficient, and therefore the kinds of questions which you ask are not applicable. If, however, that's what I'm saying, if, however, the committee would like to delve deeper into this, one method is then to apply a harm principle test where there's a schedule of offences which then correctly match the offence to the harm or the exposure of security information.
Chair, just as a follow-up, because part of what triggers that question for me is a matter that's come before the committee, which is the growing and very present risk and threat around cybersecurity, that's the kind of information we don't want. Certainly, the wrong kind of hackers. To be able to have access to, but if CETA is doing things that they're not meant to be doing, and seemingly they are, then you want that kind of thing also to be exposed. Mm. So it's a very delicate area. But I think if we talk the harm test and if we talk about proportionality of penalty to the offence, that moves us closer to a comfortable space, and certainly something for the committee to work into our deliberations. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, members, and thank you very much for coming to the committee. We appreciate your input, and we'll consider it. We will also ask the drafting team, as well as the parliamentary legal advisor, also take note of the input of the presentation of today, that we also can look at the issues raised and how we can build that into our deliberations next week. So thank you very much. Yes, members, I think we've come to the end of this meeting, but I think going to Tuesday and Wednesday, the approach should be to look at the broad issues of consensus that we already developed, and I think there's already an indication in terms of the various documents that was provided by the researcher. But then we will also isolate maybe possible areas of non-agreement amongst us, but also see how we can then address those. So Tuesday will be a broad discussion, so we'll ask the members to go back, look at the facts, look at the presentations, and then we'll have a broad discussion on the broad areas of agreement. Isolate those issues, but I think the issues that we must look at specifically is the issue of the appointment raised this morning of those private members or civil society members. What mechanism can we, as a committee, introduce to improve parliamentary oversight and participation? The issue raised this morning also about the regulations, what should be our role, is it one of approval or is it of noting? Then also the issues of private security that was raised the previous week, the issue of the offences and penalties. I think there are some solutions already in some of the draft documents, but I think the aim would be the issue of constitutionality, ensuring that we're within that parameters. So members, we will then on Tuesday, and of course if there's any additional input from the drafting team as well as from Parliament and state legal advisors, they are welcome to start with that on Tuesday, to give that input, and then we'll start with a broad discussion of the bill. Members, tea is ready, and I'm going to adjourn the meeting, and then we'll resume our activities for the week tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much. He will be communicated by the secretariat. Thank you very much.
Hello. Yeah, Pilunja. I'm going to a screen phone. We came up with a meeting. Therefore, now we're now to
mention. Hi, you want the presentation? Yeah. I'm
so I can email you.
Great work.
thank you.
Rely on your work.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. Thanks. Can someone tell us?